Michelle, and welcome to the Podluck, serving up bite-sized tastes of the best theology. I'm your host, Megan Westra. Grab a plate and let's dig in. All right, and we are back. It is another episode of The Podluck, and I'm your host, Megan Westra. Thanks so much for tuning in again. Earlier this week, we began a conversation with D.L. Mayfield talking about neighbor love and talking about how that requires us to think about our values in different ways, particularly if we are Americans of the dominant culture, so white, middle class, educated, cisgendered, heterosexual, Christian, all of these markers that are afforded the benefit of the doubt or privilege in our society. And so that was such a fun conversation for me. I really enjoyed the conversation. And today we're going to be kind of continuing along some of the themes that we started with, talking about being a good neighbor. And so today I'm super excited to introduce you to Beth Watkins. Beth has spent 6 years working in North and East Africa with vulnerable populations, and now she lives in Baltimore, Maryland, where she works with humanitarian immigrants and resettled refugees. Beth is a writer, a former missionary, a recovering white savior, and a wannabe homesteader. You can find her on Twitter and Instagram at I Am Beth Watkins. And her blog is also I Am Beth Watkins, where you can sign up for her biweekly neighborly newsletter, which is such a great newsletter. It's super fun. She is always just sending so many good resources. She's constantly linking to other people's work and just inviting all of us into a bigger and broader conversation about how to think about being a better neighbor in ways that, in ways that like this guy Jesus would invite us to. So she rounds up articles and thoughts about loving neighbors, strangers, and even our enemies better. So I was super grateful to get to talk with Beth about some of her work, about what she's seeing with clients and with the people that she is working alongside right now in Baltimore. And it's good for us to think about these things in this time. I know for me, there is this temptation, there's this pull to be like, oh my gosh, everything is so hard right now anyway. I don't want to think about anything else. But the reality is, it is challenging right now, and I don't want to minimize anything. I don't want to turn anything into like suffering Olympics. And also, I have home and internet access, and both I and my spouse are able to work from home, and my daughter can easily access assignments for school and things like that. And so there's so many things that are at my benefit right now that I just take for granted. It's just not the reality for everyone. And so I think it's important for us to keep those things in mind. And as we seek to think about life beyond a pandemic, that we are really careful to not just think about going back to normal, that we really do acknowledge that like normal doesn't work for everyone. It wasn't working. It hadn't been working for a long time. And so maybe like let's build something better instead of thinking about back to normal. What if it was build it better? And it's important to think about who we need to kind of hold in better regard as we do that. So I'm going to roll tape on this conversation. I'll drop all of Beth's links in the show notes. And you should definitely go sign up for her newsletter, follow her on all the socials. She's just a true joy and just wealth of wisdom to follow along and to engage with her work. So grab a plate. Let's dig in. All right, Beth. So you work with refugees directly. And so right now we're all in a little bit of a state of
stress or chaos or crisis or just unknown. And so caring for others certainly hasn't been top of my mind, which is embarrassing to admit, but it's true. So help us understand a little bit what this looks like for people who are on the front lines of caring for people who are constantly in a vulnerable position in our society.
Yeah, so I currently work with one of the refugee resettlement agencies in the U.S. I'm based in Baltimore, so I'm the mental health access specialist, which means that I help clients access mental health resources, and they face, on a good day, they face a number of barriers in accessing mental health resources. You know, there's confusion with insurance and finding resource like places that do interpretation for clients and transportation for clients who maybe are traumatized and have trouble learning complicated bus systems or don't have enough money for bus cards to get to appointments, which they don't deem as necessary. Things like the place of a global pandemic. With people who are already vulnerable on a lot of levels, and then we add into it just massive levels of instability. And especially for a lot of my clients now, like when all this first started happening, just very recently, like last week and right. Know, recent weeks, a lot of my clients have found it incredibly triggering, like sort of seeing empty grocery shelves, you know, things like that. People who've fled war zones or who haven't had enough to eat or who have been in refugee camps, things like that. So I think, yeah, so in my normal job, part of what I do is try to build rapport with clients. So I have overseas experience. I've lived through some trauma overseas. And so on some very small level, I can identify with my clients. And so it's important for me to build rapport with clients and try to, you know, have them know I'm an advocate. I'm here for them. But also there are limitations when you're working for a nonprofit, when you're in a direct service role, when there are like donors and funders, and also just limitations to... Yeah, like I wish I could buy your groceries every week, but I can't, you know, and trying to, but also trying to empower clients and things like that. So I think when all this first started happening and we realized, oh no, we're going to have to close our office, and how do we protect our clients from exposing them? How do we protect ourselves from exposing them? But also realizing that like mental health is a critical need for a lot of people right now, but also realizing the shifts of more critical needs suddenly. You know, clients who work in hotels, who work in, you know, cold packing plants, a lot of them have all of a sudden been laid off and suddenly are facing a lot more stability when their stability was already tenuous. So that's not an intro so much as these are questions I'm still working out, and I'm working out with my team. I mean, so I've been trying to help, you know, following up with clients really regularly, making sure that they are food secure, at least for the next couple of days, because that's what we're working with right now. Like how can we get you through the next couple of days? And then how can we get you through the next couple of days after that? And I think sometimes in direct service, and I think possibly in times of crisis, which we're in a time of crisis right now in a lot of ways, you know, sometimes, and you know, in general with language barriers and boundaries and cultural things, there's always misunderstandings and frustrations. And I think, you know, one of the reasons I got into this work is like this is Jesus. Like, you know, when we welcome the stranger, when we clothe the hungry, when we or clothe the naked, feed the hungry, when we do things like that, like that's the, like, I don't need to be Jesus. I need to see Jesus in the face of my neighbors. And so, you know, how can I make sure Jesus gets fed today, or make sure that, you know, Jesus' kids have diapers, and also creatively problem solving that when right now we're trying to limit client contact, but also want to keep clients, some of whom are very medically vulnerable, from also, you know, exposing themselves unnecessarily. But yeah, so it's challenging. It's a challenge. And I think, it's been hard, but it's good. And I think it just really highlights, gaps that are already in our systems of healthcare, of social services, of food security, and safe places to live, and low-income housing, and sort of like all of these things. And We're lucky in the city of Baltimore during this, the mayor has put a halt on evictions and on cutoffs for electricity and utilities and gas and things like that. Okay, but I'm going to have to pay it eventually anyway. How do I do that? And so, you know, I think a lot of direct services, like looking at the short term, how can we get you food today? And how can we get you services? But the real questions are, how can I keep you accessing mental health services? How can I make sure you are food secure? How can we get you job security, paid time off, paid sick leave? You know, a lot of people, refugees and asylum seekers, like enter the country having fled horrific circumstances. A lot of my clients are torture survivors, and you know, less than 1% of the world's refugees get resettled. So in a lot of senses, the ones who like make it are the lucky ones, you know, in the eyes of many. But then they land here, and you know, and like, it's hard to get health insurance, or it's hard, you know, it's hard to have stability. And then, you know, when there's a situation like this, a global pandemic, and the rug is pulled out from under my clients, but also people who are already food insecure, Americans who already live in unsafe housing in places, you know, it really highlights these gaps that we have in a way that asks me like, okay, I want this for you today, but I want this for you tomorrow. I want this for you in 10 years. Like, how can we move from stability for now? And there is a lot of like, a lot of really great things are happening, you know, right now, I think in the pandemic, obviously a lot of terrible things are happening, but in times like this, you also see people band together. There are places delivering hot meals. There's a partner organization taking diapers to some of our clients. You know, like there's, you know, I don't know, people offering protections and financial assistance and helping their elderly neighbors and like a lot of things like that. And so that is great. And I want to see more of that. But really, my question is, how can we make sure for my clients who are refugees, but also for the people I go to church with who are housing insecure, for or in prisons, like how can we make sure that these safeties are here, not just for the next global pandemic, but in the day to day, next year, 5 years, 10 years. So I think my questions are like, I'm really happy to be in direct service and to like, kind of emergency response. I've done humanitarian work overseas, so it's not quite, but there's definitely like a humanitarian response feel right now. Like, okay, you need food for the weekend. Like you don't have anything to eat. You know, your kids don't have enough. You're a family of eight and you're like, okay, like how can we get you enough today? And I think that's the thing that's really like, especially when I was like 17 and wanted to save the world, like that's part of why I moved overseas. Like, I want to feed the hungry and I do this. And then that's great. But as I get older, as I've become more acquainted with suffering and befriended more people who are vulnerable, who are targeted, my questions more are less of like, how can I feed you today? Like, how can we be in a world that has enough food? We're like in a country where, you know, 30% of food gets wasted or something like that. Like, how can we improve our supply chains, improve our systems, improve our protections? Like, I want you to be fed today, but I also really care about you not having to be stressed every week or every month or the next global pandemic of how like, you have enough food. Like, how do we take the stores that so many have and how do we distribute them equitably in a way that will last? So, go ahead.
No, so it sounds like what you're saying, and I, if it is what you're saying, then I tend to agree with you, that the charity that we're seeing, this outpouring of resources that we're seeing, whether it's from governments or from nonprofits or from businesses or whoever, is good. It's needed. But it would be maybe better or at least equally important for us to think about how do we build our systems in such a way where this much charity is not needed or where this like outpouring of like niceness almost of like, oh, we get to do this really nice thing. We get to do this really good thing where that isn't a necessary thing because everybody just has enough. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And I think this is something I really started questioning when I moved overseas and started working with really vulnerable populations. I worked with street kids for a couple of years at centers. And then I also I worked with refugees in Egypt for a couple of years before moving back to the U.S. And like, so for an example, I lived in a country, street girls, for a couple of years. And like people loved, especially like people who worked for embassies and something that was loved giving donations and like all this stuff. And that was great. we'll take it. The girls need clothes. Like, that's great. And one day there was just this, like, we were also doing an initiative for, like, selling things that the girls made to try to have, like, savings and things like that. And one day there was this, like, big group of, like, 50 people from this international organization that came and, like, painted the thing. And, like, people had painted the place where we lived, like, a few months before. It didn't really need to be painted. Mm-hmm. But that's what they wanted to do. And you sort of, like, want to be like, yeah, okay, like, sure. Well, yeah, I'm not going to, like, squelch your generosity, even if it's, like, not what I would have wanted. And then they left. They didn't buy, like, any of the things that the girls had made or sort of do things like that. And, like, you know, like, I want to be careful not to say, like, it was worse than nothing. Like, it wasn't. That was fine. But, like, are we, like, I think we sort of start, like, seeing differently the best ways of helping when we actually start being in relationship, befriending, or, like, putting ourselves in proximity with the people who are the recipients or whatever of our charity. So, like, kindness is great. And I think kindness is one of the great virtues, you know, and it's something that Paul talked about, like, be kind. Like, that's part of love. That's part of, you know, neighborly love or Christian love, you know, being kind. But it's not enough. Like, we can't stop there. Like, we need to ask questions. We need to pan out. I have one of my clients a couple of months ago is from a country in the Middle East. And, you know, I did, like, an intake interview, and we talked a little bit about, like, their history and some of that. And at the end they said, oh, like, you're a very kind person. Thank you for helping me. And I'm like, that's great. Like, yay. Like, I want to be a kind person. Like, I'm happy you said that. It makes me feel good. But in the same breath, my mind immediate was like, my country has, like, bombed the heck out of yours. Like, this person has refugees who've died because of our international policies, you know, and stuff like that. And I'm like, that's great that you think that I'm kind, but it also, it's not enough. Like, I want my country to stop bombing yours. Like, you know, like, and like, it's good. Like, be kind to those that you meet, but, like, what about, like, do our actions reap kindness on those we will never meet? Those that we haven't met yet? Like, I put myself in proximity with, you know, I'm so lucky I get the job that I do. I love my work. I love working with refugees. I love working in direct service. But I also, so I want my actions to reap kindness on them, obviously. But, you know, most people don't get to work vocationally with refugees or people who are homeless or poor, you know, like, and that's fine. Like, but, like, how can my actions reap kindness on those I will never meet? The people who pick my food and grow my food and, like, like, how can, like, and the people who are affected by the foreign policies of my country? We're asking the wrong questions if we're asking it from our perspective of, like, trying to figure out what people need now. What people need right now is groceries and jobs once this recovers, and we need a vaccine, you know, and things like that. We need those things, but also in the long term, or for example, like, we need more masks stacked for our healthcare workers. So, like, that's important. People need to be buying masks, sewing masks, sourcing masks. Like, I don't know exactly, but like our healthcare workers need masks yesterday, like last week, month ago. But they also, our healthcare workers want there to be a vaccine, you know, as soon as it can be ready, which won't be tomorrow or next week or next month, you know. But so let's offer charity now to people who are hungry and who need it, you know, and let's offer safety and security. But, like, they also want a vaccine from the kind of poverty they're experiencing now. And we're seeing right now, like, there's enough for all of us. But, you know, if we can make it happen now, why can't we make it happen in a way that will benefit all of us in the future? The charity is good, but unless it leads to, like, lasting change, I don't want to say what's the point of it, because there is a point in it. Like, people who are hungry are no longer hungry. But if we're not really panning out and asking questions of how can we stop people from being hungry, you know, for the rest of their lives or for the next decade or whatever, like, why does that not matter as much, I think, is my question too. Like, that's great, but can we pan out? Yeah.
It makes me think of, like, often in the Bible you see justice and mercy paired together, right? And so I think that in a lot of ways, a lot of especially religious circles or faith-based circles, we function as if those are the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. That like mm-hmm. mercy and justice have become completely enmeshed, in part because our systems are so broken. And so there mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. such a need for like this acute compassion, charitable, merciful kind mm-hmm. of response. But then we do these compassionate acts or these charitable acts, and we feel like we're pursuing justice. Mm-hmm. But really, we're just meeting an acute need. Like we're giving groceries or masks or whatever, right? Like if we're mm-hmm. gonna keep following those analogies. But I mean, you can apply that to any number of situations, right? Where we'll all slap a bumper sticker on our cars or mm-hmm. our laptops. I had one on my old laptop, right? That was like, immigrants and refugees, welcome. Because I wanted to support Good. And I wanted to let people know that like, hey, I support this. And as a pastor, especially in like 2016, that felt like an important move to make to be like, hey,
yeah, totally.
But I'm not in direct care. I'm not in direct, you know, contact. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, there's only so much I could do. But I also did like move further and be like, okay, I need to call my senators and I need to do this and I need to do that. Like to, mm-hmm. to try to move that justice needle forward, because mm-hmm. just sticking a sticker on my computer or, you know, there's other ways that congregations will mobilize, you know, oh, we're going to collect mm-hmm. groceries for this, you know, family that's being resettled in our community or whatever. Those are good things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I feel like this, when we say that we're pursuing justice, and we're actually doing acts of mercy or compassion or charity, maybe that's part of what you're getting at, is like justice is a bigger thing. It's the vaccine.
Yeah. That's a good point. And I like that you talk about it together, because it is justice and mercy. Because if we only focus on the vaccine, right? The people right. who need masks today go without masks, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, and I think sometimes in my desire for justice or striving for, you know, like panning out. Sometimes you can pan out too much and you forget to see the person in front of you who also right. needs mercy now. So I think it's this ebb and flow. I come back to, you know, on and off, like my client needs diapers today, right? Mm-hmm. And then also like, how do we work for her? Like long-term job security and like kind of like right. stuff like that. And then like go back to, okay, but she's, you know, still hungry today. Like, how do I make her self-sufficient? And like, not make her, but like help her become self-sufficient and things right. like that. And like, how do we, yeah, like, yeah, no, I absolutely agree, but I like that you talk about it together. And I think if, you know, I grew up a lot thinking a lot about mercy, and that's part of why I moved overseas. You know, I wanted to change the world, you know, and kind of mm-hmm. like, and love the least of these, which, you know, if I, you know, one of my Twitter friends, Mektis Haddis, she's an Ethiopian woman who lives in the US, and she writes and talks a lot about how like she's encountered a lot of Americans who've like called her people the least of these. Like they'll go like go back to Ethiopia on trips, and she's like, nobody likes being called the least of these. And I was like, oh, dip, like you're right. Like we shouldn't, you know. And so, and I think that's because I had this idea of mercy, like this person who, you know, is least of these, and you know, and I'm like, I'm gonna help, and like I think that was a really good desire, but I think it was an immature one. You know, it hadn't been fleshed out fully, and you know, we could talk about white saviorism and kind of go into a lot of yeah. that. There are people who talk about it much better than I do, and there are good resources for that. But that's a part of that conversation as well. But I think, you know, mercy is a good desire, right? And I think we shouldn't lose that. And I think that is a deep part of our, you know, of a Christian faith, is being merciful and compassionate and not running out of those things or becoming calloused in it, mm-hmm. which when you work with people with a lot of needs, that's hard to do. Sometimes you do need right. to, you know, take out the pumice stone and like really like ask God to soften your heart again and again when people who hurt you or don't appreciate you or anything like that. But like, you know, if we're not, if that mercy isn't taking us to deeper places and asking bigger questions, and I think we're really missing out on, you know, a consistent ethic of neighborliness or a consistent ethic of neighborly love. You know, I have to care about, you know, the client in front of me who needs needs mental health resources and who has needs, but I also need to pan out and ask, like, and have mercy on you know, in compassion because of her story and what she's been through, and ask like, how can my people stop hurting hers? You know, how can, yeah. These are, you know, complicated geopolitical, economical things, but I think this is important. Why, you know, like I used to only read sort of like Christian living books or things like that. Or in college, I just read a lot of like, how can I be a better Christian? How can I love Jesus more? You know, I didn't read as many history books or, you know, books about economics or social issues and things like that. And not that we all have to be, you know, profoundly well-read. And I wouldn't even say that I am. But like, I find that the more that I read about things that aren't just about how much like Jesus loves me and how I can love Jesus better, but the more I read about the way that people treat each other and my own history and, you know, like things that have created the world that we have today. And also the realities of the world as it is that I, you know, as a sort of middle-class white woman, I wouldn't normally see unless I'm really looking for paying attention. Like the more I actually learn about the kingdom of God, right? Like the kingdom of God is things that are far from my view, things that I have to seek out. And even with a tremendous amount of intention, like I read a lot of news. I follow a lot of people who are different than me online. You know, I work with people who speak many languages. I speak another language. Like I lived overseas for 6 years. My husband is an immigrant. Like I try really hard to, you know, the face of God is in all of us, like see how many faces, how many facets of God I can read, learn from, talk to, you know, and even with a tremendous amount of intention, like it's still, we don't have the full picture, but how can we, you know, and that's part of this work too, in justice, in mercy, like finding the face of God in people. But like, what does that propel us to do? Like, what is that? How does that, like, yeah, like there's like a Christian song, like that asks like, when they see me, do we see you? And I'm like, no, like, that's not the right question. I don't want people to look at me and see Jesus, because I'm like, aren't disappointment. Like, I don't know, really wrong. Like, but also like, I want to find Jesus in the face of my neighbors, because that's where he said he was, you know, like in the parable of the sheep and the goats, like, you know, we're like the great judgment is, you know, who's on the right and who left, like, what, Lord, when were you hungry and we didn't feed you? When were you thirsty? We didn't see you. And that's mercy and compassion. But I think those questions also ask, like, when were we bombing you and we didn't stop? You know, when were we buying things from slave labor and we didn't know? And, you know, like, when did we accidentally participate in gentrification, kick you out of your home and didn't know? And like, things like, I mean, there's a million ways, and like, I don't think we can do all of it. And sometimes, like, as an Enneagram one, I drive myself crazy trying to find all the ways I'm doing it wrong and could be doing better. And so I have to find balance in that for myself. But I think, like, just like starting and asking those questions, like, where does my life intersect with the lives of my neighbors? You know, like, where this injustice, or like welcoming strangers, having refugees, you know, like, jail, like justice for people in the political, in the criminal justice system. And like, how can, you know, and I can't do all of it, right? I can't be involved in all of it. I can't even care deeply about all of it as much as I would like to. But like, you know, in the life that I have now and the things that I'm doing today, the things I'd like to do tomorrow, how can I look at the intersections of my lives with the lives of neighbors, look at it creatively and ask questions about how that can be for their good, you know, and instead of like, my security is important to me. Like I do want to feel safe and secure. Like I think everyone does. And I think that's okay. But I think we can't have that at the expense of safety and security of others, and really believing we can flourish together and asking how can we make that happen in an imperfect world with imperfect people? But, you know, how can we, because like, I think that's when we start to get to the kingdom. And I think that's what we should be living and working towards, or at least what I hope I'm doing in my best days, you know?
Yeah. That's so good. There's a prayer by, I think it's Oscar Romero, and there's a line in it that's like, we cannot do everything. And in that, there's a sense of freedom.
And so, makes me grumpy, but yeah.
Yeah, I know. It makes me grumpy too. And so I have spent a lot of time meditating on that particular line of the prayer, especially in the last couple of weeks. And I'm equally grumpy and comforted. As we kind of round out this conversation today, there's a lot of people right now in their homes, and some with more time to think than they're possibly comfortable with. And so I'm wondering, for people who, like you or like me, are maybe like middle-class white people, with a very limited scope of what we understand about the world, if we're being honest with ourselves, that we like to think that we're experts in lots of areas, but we really have a very limited scope of what we actually understand and what we're actually equipped to deal with. What would be a question that you would invite people to consider as they think about how to love their neighbors right now? Or what an ethic of neighborliness looks like when we are so encouraged both by public health information, which is good and we should follow it. We should isolate or social distance or shelter at home or whatever, all the words that are flying around. We are encouraged to really narrow our focus right now. And also, like, just biologically, we are, you know, we are stressed and we're going through chaos. And so we're getting very narrow in our focus. What would be a question that you would encourage people to sit with to kind of invite ourselves to expand how we think of neighborliness in this time and in this season? Or maybe something we can think about now and enact on the other side of this.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's a good question.
You can sit with it for a minute.
Yeah. I mean, I think the question I've been asking myself is, what does neighbor love look like in a global pandemic? Because it does look a bit different than it would in other times. And I think leading into that question, then what can it look like when this is over? Because I think those look different. So normally I'm asking, how can you put yourself into proximity with people who are different than you, which I think is good. But when we're social distancing, like, you can't try a new church, you know, or like go volunteer somewhere new necessarily, or at least without, you know, a lot of wisdom. So I think in part that can be following different people online and things like that. But I think, like, you know, ask yourself, like, what does neighborly love look like right now in a global pandemic? And that answer is as different as we are different. And I think looking at it twofold, with sort of the mercy, compassion hand, and also the justice hand. And maybe the immediate in a global pandemic is with the mercy, compassion, and then sort of arching out injustice. What can it look like, or what should it look like when this is over? You know, like, let's not go back to life as normal, but how can I love my neighbor well in a global pandemic, especially my neighbors who are different than me or more vulnerable than me? And then how should it look when this is over? And just really try to sit and ponder on that. That's what I'm doing. A lot of as well. Yeah.
Good. That's good. Yeah. No, I think it's interesting that, like, yeah, I know there's certain cities, my city is one of them, where there's internet companies that are just saying, you can have this, you can have access to the internet for free. And I find myself asking, like, okay, so we've done this so that children can have access to educational things or people can do their jobs or whatever, but why wasn't that a thing before?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think as we get out to the other side of this, there's going to be questions that I'll be asking of the people that represent me in the government and things like that, to say, like, hold on, like, why was this something that we could provide and now we cannot? Why are there now these barriers between certain people being able to access things? You know, and at this point in my life, I've had the internet in my house, Wi-Fi in my house for 8 years. I didn't the first year out of college, the first year that I was married. And, you know, I don't remember life before that now. But it can change people's lives, because it does open so many opportunities for education and for jobs and for telehealth and mental health services, and like so many things. And so I think, just as one very small example, that's a question I'm going to be asking on the other side, is like, hold on, like, why was this an essential amenity that people had, you know, a right to? And now you're trying to say maybe it's not.
Yeah. Why do we only get equity in an emergency?
That's a good, I'm just going to leave that there. That's a good thought to leave us with. Why do we only get equity in an emergency?
It's been interesting to see in the weeks since Beth and I recorded that episode how even the things that seemed like they might be leading us toward equity in this emergency, things like access to the internet and certain types of relief, have not really done what we had hoped they would do, at least not what I had hoped they had would do. And maybe that's just me being naive, that in the weeks since we recorded, it's become even more apparent that even in this emergency, even in the ways that we have tried to say, let's put more supports in place, that it still is disproportionately benefiting some people and leaving others out. And so I want to keep asking questions. And that's one of the things that I appreciate most about Beth and her work, is she helps ask better questions. And so I think it's good to continue to think through, why are there things that we are suddenly able to do now that we were not able to do before? Whether that's, you know, free or more affordable internet access, or, you know, sliding scales for medical costs in certain locations, different things like that. But also, even as we're asking those questions, that we recognize that even the ways that we're starting to see increased access in some ways is still very far from equitable. And so I lament that in the weeks since we first recorded this episode, that the equity hasn't increased, or that access hasn't increased in the same trajectory that it did in those first couple weeks that we were social distancing. There's no easy answers, but for people like me who could easily say, well, I have all the things I need and my kid has access to things with school and we're able to get all of our groceries and things like that, that I don't universalize that experience and say, well, why are you complaining? Like, just do this, right? That's like, that's not it. That's not a reality. And so I think being mindful that my experience is not everyone's, and my experience navigating this pandemic is in many ways not that challenging. And that's because I'm a white middle-class woman in a lot of ways, and I have access to certain networks and certain resources that I don't have any, I didn't earn them. It's just pure privilege. It's the birth lottery, right? I was born in this body to certain people and have made this, I mean, this is my life. So I'm starting to get lost in my own thoughts and my own processing and my own trying to ask better questions. But I'm grateful for Beth and the ways that she invites me to ask better questions, and the ways that her experience and her work have helped her to see the own ways, her own ways of wrestling through things in different ways. So I'm grateful that she joined me for this interview, and I will drop all of her links in the show notes. Please do subscribe to her newsletter and continue to learn to ask better questions with all of the links and the resources that she rounds up. If you are not already subscribed, go ahead and hit the subscribe button so that you don't miss any episodes of the Podluck in this Corona Kegger season or in any other seasons. If you share this or other episodes online, please use @PodluckPodcast on Twitter, @ThePodluckPodcast on Instagram. As always, I've been your host, Megan Westra. Thanks so much for tuning in, for joining me on this journey to ask better questions, to hold different ideas of what kind of normal we want to return to, and to have the things that maybe we're really missing right now or longing for, to have those things be challenged, so that whenever the other side of this is, we could actually start to move toward equity. Wouldn't that be great? So join in next time, grab a plate, and we'll dig in then.